From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the UAW's International Executive Board meets to consider reforms in the face of the growing federal corruption probe. But
people are looking into that board as saying, are you really the people that are supposed to clean this up?
In a big bipartisan vote, the State House moves to make it easier to get out from under the cloud of an old conviction.
It can affect the way they approach employment, where they live, who they associate with, you know, any number of things.
Our prison series, Life on the Inside, continues with a look at parenting from behind bars and one inmate's message to his kids.
I try to tell them that don't let me being in this situation be such a burden or a hamper on their life and their ability to succeed.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, parenting from behind prison walls.
The hardest part of being a parent in prison is missing everything, hearing everything and seeing everything, you know, so much later than it actually happens.
How one father stays connected to his kids while incarcerated. That conversation later on today's program, plus more from our series, Life on the Inside. But first, they're on, they're off, they're talking, they're not. That's the ever-shifting situation with budget talks between Governor Whitmer and the Republican legislative leaders seeking a path toward resolving the governor's nearly $1 billion in budget vetoes. Earlier today, it looked like the sides were close to a deal, but then, plot twist, Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta, walk us through the ins and outs of this day.
This morning it seemed like they might be close, that there were some bargains on the table to restoring these budget actions. I mean, they total roughly $1 billion, and trying to get the budget back on track. The people who were feeling some anxiety over the cuts that were coming, we're talking about rural hospitals, money that goes to local sheriff's departments for road patrols, some funding for autism services and other human services. The list goes on. And I mean, no one's really happy with this. Republicans aren't happy with it because it affects a lot of their districts and they're feeling like the governor's trying to push them around. The governor isn't happy with this, and she says she wants to bargain to restore, you know, these cuts. And she said that they were close enough that this could be dealt with quickly.
If the legislature wants to get that done into my desk, it can be just a matter of hours at this point.
Okay, so that's promising. Then what happened?
Well, she said it could be done in a matter of hours, and she may be right, but there's this discussion among Republicans as to what it would take to ensure that the governor keeps her word.
The majority leader cannot rely upon the governor making a promise.
And that's Amber McCann. She's the press secretary for State Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey, a Republican. He and House Speaker Lee Chatfield, also a Republican, have been in negotiations with the governor on what some of us are calling Budget 2.0, the new version that restores a lot of these cuts and maybe restores some modicum of trust between the governor's office and Republicans in the legislature. Everybody is saying they're close, they're close, they're close. And then we found out they might be close, but they're not there yet.
And what is the big stumbling block, Rick?
The big stumbling block, and a warning, it's technical, is what it would take, what mechanism would it take for everyone to agree that this is a bargain and that this is a bargain that everyone would stick to. I mean, you might remember that the governor turned to the State Administrative Board. It's made up of members of her cabinet as well as some other elected officials. Right now, they're all Democrats who did funding shifts after she did some budget vetoes. And Republicans said, well, this may be legal, but this isn't what we signed up for. And so now they want some assurances that there won't be a repeat of that. And they want them enacted in a state law, a bill that would be adopted by the legislature, by the House and by the Senate. And Governor Whitmer would have to sign it. And that would mean that there would be consequences if she tried to do that again. And the governor's response thus far and continuing is that she's willing to do lots of things. She's willing to hold a press conference. She's willing to issue a letter, that she's willing to, you know, turn to all kinds of public assurances that this wouldn't happen again. And the Republican, at least the Senate Republican response to date is, that's not good enough. We want consequences. We want a state law.
And so they want to somewhat curb her powers to shuffle that money around. Meantime, the clock is thundering, isn't it, before lawmakers are going to be gone for a while?
There will be a deer hunting break that's coming soon, but the Senate will be around for a little while longer before the winter break begins, before the winter holidays. But there's still just this standoff. And even though they're very, very close, it's just like anyone who watches a football game knows, it's that final yard that can be the toughest to get things across the goal line.
Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief, Rick Pluta. As always, Rick, thank you.
As always, a pleasure.
Imagine what it's like to be Rory Gamble, 45 years in the UAW, chosen last Saturday as acting president after embattled President Gary Jones took a leave of absence in the midst of the federal corruption probe that seems to get wider and deeper with every passing week. On Wednesday, Gamble told us his reforms begin with today's International Executive Board meeting.
I am going to be presenting to our board a number of initiatives that I want to enact right away and going forward, and how we turn this thing around. They are going to be some very hard and some very unpopular things that we're going to have to do, but we don't have a choice.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us. Daniel, what are you hearing about what these initiatives of Rory Gamble's might include?
Not really. We had been told yesterday, my colleague Rob Snell and I, that one of the things that some people expected who were close to the union was potentially that Rory Gamble would dismiss the general counsel, who had led an internal investigation into the corruption that was largely linked to the Fiat Chrysler Joint Training Center. And they declared that the corruption stopped with Vice President Norwood Jewell, who headed that department. We've since seen this mushroom and grow a lot bigger. I don't know what he's got up his sleeve, but I can tell you that if it doesn't include cleaning out some individuals in the organization, I don't quite understand how you're going to get your arms around what the federal authorities have called this culture of corruption within the leadership of the UAW, that when you start to look at this and aggregate it as opposed to disaggregate it, you realize that this is a nationwide thing. You have the Joe Ashton indictment just of this week in the East Coast, the Philadelphia, South Jersey area. You've had stuff going on here in Detroit. You have stuff in Region 5 in St. Louis. You have Palm Springs in California. I mean, there is relationships among some of those things, but in a lot of cases, they're disparate things that are kind of spinning, but they're all kind of doing the same kind of thing. One of the common denominators is both kickbacks, but most more importantly, the use of member dues on some of these things.
With yesterday's charges against retired VP Joe Ashton, we're looking at 13 now. Is that what we're up to?
Yep, 13 and 10 convictions, I believe.
Mm-hmm. You've reviewed court papers suggesting more to come?
Oh, yeah. Based on what we've seen, we'd think there's at least two more lesser individuals in terms of rank that have been named and referred to in court papers, as well as the people we have identified the Detroit News through our sources as being Gary Jones, UAW Official A, the president of the United Auto Workers, and his predecessor, Dennis Williams, as UAW Official B.
And as you point out, and you and Robert Snell in your story today, it was actually Dennis Williams who not long ago was promising a deep reform of the union.
Well, that's the irony here. Both Dennis Williams, in his clean slate agenda, what he called that in 2017, and then Gary Jones in 18 as he acceded to the top of the union, they both promised this. They both talked about how appalling it was that the union members or union officials were taking advantage of the situation and availing themselves of funds either earmarked for members by the corporations or collected from the members in their dues. And now they are in the frame by what the federal government is saying as having been doing exactly what they were decrying.
What is the take on Rory Gamble? Is this the guy that is the right one to face this threat of a government takeover of the UAW?
Well, you talk to people that have been through this, and certainly if you talk to people that are familiar with the situation with the Teamsters, it is possible that there is going to be some kind of federal takeover, probably at a minimum some kind of financial monitor. And Mr. Gamble's right that you need to really be very, very proactive. Invariably, the response has been viewed as tepid and not going far enough. How long it took them to get Gary Jones to step aside was an issue. Rory Gamble, by all accounts, seems to be well-liked. He's headed the Ford Department. I think he was in Region 1A for some period of time. So he's been firmly kind of planted in that Western Wayne County, Dearborn, Ford orbit. The Ford people speak very highly of him. I think the way in which he was able to get a tentative agreement at Ford after a six-week strike at General Motors, even you could see it in the what they call the highlighter that they send out to the members. The difference between the GM highlighter and the Ford highlighter was night and day. The Ford highlighter was much more detailed, better put together, explained what the investment commitments by Ford Motor Company would be over the next 4 years. It was just on a whole other level. And I think he's trying to set the right tone. But the reality is there's a lot of people in the governing International Executive Board of the union who are in some way, shape, or form either compromised by this whole scandal, or they were the assistant to somebody, or their assistant. For example, Cindy Estrada is a vice president and head of the FCA department. Her AA, her administrative assistant, was indicted as part of the Ashton thing in the East Coast. And she said to people at the time, I didn't know about any of this until I read about it in the newspaper. Well, I think a lot of people are like, really? You know, you didn't know? That's, you know, either you didn't, if you don't know, it says something bad. And if you did know, it says something bad. So, and she's just one example. And there are other members of that board. So I think you have a lot of that going on. And I think people are looking into that board as saying, are you really the people that are supposed to clean this up? You know, this is a board of directors and a management board all rolled into one. And they are answerable only to the members once every 4 years. And that's not even a direct election. One of the reforms that may end up being forced on the UAW is that they have to move to direct elections, which means you directly elect the president by name, just the way you elect a governor or you elect the mayor of a city.
Detroit News business columnist and associate business editor Daniel Howes, thanks so much.
You bet.
Coming up, a bill to make some crimes go away after 10 years moves ahead in Lansing. We'll look at what this could mean for people who are trying to move ahead in life. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
This superb one-direction highway is engineered for easy grades and for speed with safety. The echoes of that two-cylinder motor have never died, and they never will.
Call the turn signal! Use it! Learn to drive!
Back for another installment of our Learn to Drive series is Lieutenant Mike Shaw of the Michigan State Police. Good to have you back, Lieutenant.
Thank you.
So, Lieutenant, we're going to talk about a hot topic across the state, and that's the shared space on the road as we talk about motor vehicles, bicycles, and pedestrians. And let's start with the bicycles. What are the statewide laws that concern motor vehicles and bicycle interaction?
So this is always a topic that gets me in trouble with the other segments as we kind of go along, because we always say that the roadways are for everybody. It's not just for cars, it's just not for bicycles, and it's just not for pedestrians. And all three of those groups make errors in judgment as they kind of go along trying to share the road because they think they all got it. So for bicycles, the law was just passed that you have to pass within 3 feet. Now, naturally, is a state trooper got a tape measure and he's going to kind of go up there. But what we're trying to do with that particular law is to give those bicycles a lane too. a hot topic of conversation is all the bike lanes that are going in my area of the state, in Detroit, is for one. You either love them or hate them, and there's no middle ground. But if there's no bike lane, that person on the bicycle has just as much access to that traffic lane as the other people as well. So just remember, you know, give them the same space. And talking back to my friends on the bicycle, those traffic rules apply to you as well. You don't get to freely use the road and then just run through stop signs and traffic lights and things like that. So you can actually get a ticket riding a bicycle for violating a traffic control device.
Now, one of my producers made an interesting point that this car bike law you referred to, it does possibly force drivers to break other laws. So let's say you're on a two-lane road. You've got to give that minimum of space for safety. But by doing that, you cross the center median line and you're breaking the law.
So some of it is common sense. I know that's two bad words that we're putting together in this time and day, but common sense kind of rules. So if you got to go over that little yellow line a little bit to avoid running over a bicyclist, then yeah, go ahead and go over that little yellow line. Now we'll let you pass on that one. We'll give you the break. We'd rather you do that than go over there. But we also got to remind our bicyclists as well, the law does say that you're supposed to be as close to the curb as you can, and it can only ride two abreast. So that law kind of takes place as well. So there's a lot of things that go together with all these traffic rules. And I'm going to tell you, common sense is the biggest thing in the world, because, you know, the legislature can make laws for anything that they want up there. But common sense is really something that we need to get back into the quotient. A little common sense and a little common courtesy. I don't know where it went away. We used to wave at people, let people in. Now we give them the one finger salute and try to run them off the road.
What are requirements for bicyclists when they're on the road? Do they need to have lights? Do they need flags? What's the rule?
So they have to have the reflectors that are on there, because most bicyclists that are on the road probably aren't running around with the big orange flag and a banana seat like when I was a kid. They're more designed for people to actually get to and from to work. There's a lot of people that commute by their bicycle. So those reflectors that are standard are usually already on the bicycle, but you do need to have, you know, a light front and back when you're riding at night. There's no requirement for having a bicycle helmet, but let's face the facts. You know, it only takes one time to fall on one of those things and hit your head that you'll say, I think I should have wore a bicycle helmet.
All right, let's turn to pedestrians.
Sure.
In some Michigan cities, it kind of seems like pedestrians have 100% right of way. They can walk into the road whenever they want, and drivers must immediately react, and they risk getting hit from behind. Other cities, pedestrians are seen and given no quarter. What is Michigan's rule?
Yep. So there may be some local ordinances that, you know, you always got to consider of where you're going, and that kind of makes it tricky. But state law is very clear. The biggest offenders when it comes to that is usually the pedestrian. You're required to cross at a crosswalk. There's no gray lines. There's no, it doesn't matter if it's a block away or I didn't want to walk that far and walk all over there. You're required to use a crosswalk. Vehicles have the right of way on the roadway until a person actually enters that crosswalk. Once they enter the crosswalk, then that person has a right of way and then vehicles have to stop. Now, naturally, if you're in a downtown area, you know, pay attention to what's going on, because, you know, you're driving that big hunk of metal compared to somebody that's only protection is that. So, again, I'm going to use those deadly two words. Common sense always kind of prevails over it. But that is one of my pet peeves that bothers me to no end, is somebody that stands either in the left turn lane or just randomly just kind of crosses the road without looking. I think a lot of people don't understand. When the light is white, or it has a little white man or woman walking across there, you're free to walk across that crosswalk. You have the right of way. If it is starting to flash orange, you are not allowed to enter that crosswalk. So once it's flashing, you're all done. So if you enter that crosswalk, you do not have the right of way. And then naturally, if it's a solid light, then you can't enter it either. The pedestrian is usually the bigger offender than the vehicle traffic.
Interesting. Well, as someone who crosses at a zebra crosswalk that does not have a light, but the city of Ann Arbor puts up these warning signs to tell drivers, I can't count how many times I've almost gotten creamed. You think that person coming at you is going to see you in the crosswalk, and they sail right past.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's some different markings for that. Some use the actual hawk warning lights where the pedestrian can actually hit it and it starts to blink yellow and then red, and it becomes a traffic signal where everybody has to stop, which is probably the safest way to do it other than a regular traffic signal. Some have the little blinking warning lights on them, probably not as effective. And then there's ones that are just not marked. And I think people don't realize anytime that you have an intersection there, even if there's not a marked crosswalk, that connection from one sidewalk to the other Leader becomes, according to the Michigan Vehicle Code, an actual crosswalk itself, even though the lines aren't there and the same rules apply.
Bottom line, for motorists, pedestrians, and cyclists, what do they always have to keep top of mind?
Common sense. I mean, we'll nail this probably on any interview that I do about any topic. Common sense is going to come out there. The road belongs to everybody. Remember, if you're in the vehicle, you're the one that can cause the most damage to somebody else. So even if you have the right of way and somebody else is in there, don't force the issue. Just be common. Give them a wave and a smile and send them on their way.
Michigan State Police Lieutenant Mike Shaw, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Across the country, the mood seems to be changing about incarceration and looking at criminal justice reform, and that includes expunging criminal records. Here in Michigan, there is a bipartisan push toward expungement reform, making it easier for certain convictions to be hidden to the public. A bill allowing certain crimes to automatically be removed from someone's record after 10 years passed the House this week, along with a batch of other legislation making expungement easier. Here with us now is State Representative Eric Leuthauser, who's a Republican from Branch in Hillsdale County. He sponsored House Bill 4980. Representative, welcome to Stateside.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
Let's start right at the ground level. What is expungement? We hear the word used, but exactly what does it mean?
Well, I first would like to clarify that there are two different ways of looking at this, and the word expungement is sometimes misapplied. Expungement is literally blotting something out so that if it never occurred, and that is typically done in a very narrow number of circumstances with a magistrate through an agreement. If you do X, Y, Z, then we will remove this charge. It'll be as if it never happened. Sometimes it happens for a first offender during the beginning part of their process and so forth. But expungement is quite rare, but it's used to kind of explain that idea of giving someone a fresh start or a clean slate. My bill actually applies to a process which is known as set aside, where the charges are not expunged per se, but they are only visible or considered in the future by perhaps, if someone reoffends, by a judge or a magistrate or a prosecutor. So for all intents and purposes, someone has a clean slate, they get that fresh start, they have that monkey off their backs, but the charges never really go away completely under my legislation.
So for the people that might have these past misdeeds hidden from public eye, the set-aside, what does that mean for people getting on with their lives?
It can mean everything. Human beings are complicated, and we have our consciences, and we've got our past, and we have our histories and so forth. And if someone has a misdeed and they did something when they're young, and that's out there, so to speak, kind of a cloud over them, they know it's there. Maybe if no one else even knows it's there, it can affect the way they approach employment, where they live, who they associate with, any number of things. And the powerful thing about this, from my standpoint, the automatic or default set-aside, is that after a number of years pass by and someone's been a solid citizen, those things are automatically set aside so they have that cloud lifted, and it just allows them a lot more opportunities. Now, clearly this is being looked at from an economic standpoint. It's a big motivator, because some people would now be eligible to apply for jobs that they wouldn't be eligible for otherwise. It'll make them eligible for housing they would not be otherwise be eligible for. There's a big economic impact to this. And that's a big driver for this conversation nationwide. But just philosophically, that's kind of where I was coming from on this.
And your bill and six others passed the House this week. Just give us a sense, broadly speaking, how would they change the set-aside and expungement systems in our state?
Absolutely. First of all, they did pass with wide bipartisan support. What this means is marijuana is now treated differently in the state than it was 10 or 15 years ago. A lot of those crimes are going to be, those offenses would be set aside. Traffic tickets, those kinds of things. On the auto or default set-aside, now you go to into the courthouse and you petition to have your offenses set aside. Anyone can do that for a large number of crimes. And by making it the default, so it automatically happens, my bill would make it more like at the License Bureau, where if you have points on your license, maybe you're speeding or something, a couple years goes by, those points just drop off. It's narrowly tailored to offenses that are nonviolent. They don't affect trafficking. They don't affect crimes against elderly or juveniles and so forth. So we have put public safeguards in this process, put public safety front and center also.
Representative, you pointed to the very strong bipartisan support, and that certainly was reported. For example, Gongwer talks about this, used the terms extraordinary margins, and pointed out that it's the third time this term where criminal justice reform that in a prior term may have been an uphill battle to get out of either legislative chamber passed. So, very little pushback. Why do you think what's changed?
Well, I do think, in our role here, there's always a sense of what are our priorities and what are urgent matters and those things sort of shift sometimes rather quietly and sometimes under the surface. This issue has been around for a long time. Some of these other issues I think you're speaking to, like civil asset forfeiture and so forth, some of those issues were around for years and years and years. And sometimes I think the momentum gets to a point where people look around and say, let's just get this done. We've been talking about it long enough. I think there's probably as much to the calculus to that underlying momentum as there is to any other gaming out you could do as far as a partisan breakdown or divided government. I really do think it was just time. Hmm. I think that's the case with this legislation. I know I started talking about several years ago. So the stakeholders start talking about it. You start to get more stakeholders. You reach out to more people. You find out you've got other people that are also interested in it. And the momentum kind of builds gradually and gets to a point where you can get something done.
There was a question about this from Bill Valancourt, who's president of the Prosecuting Attorneys Association of Michigan, who says he wouldn't trust an algorithm to sort out someone who deserves expungement from someone who doesn't. Let's take a quick listen.
For example, a generic malicious destruction of property might involve vandalizing a car. Nobody'd have a problem with expungements there. But it might also involve vandalizing a church with racial epithets.
What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think those are fair concerns. I've heard from caucus members that were not excited about this process, that they thought that it was important to always have a human being have one last look at each set aside or expungement. I would say, and I would like your listeners to know, that this bill that I'm talking about and that I sponsored does have a lot of technical hurdles in front of it. We currently do not have the system, the IT system in the state or any state to make this, to effectuate these changes. Usually when we pass a bill, Cindy, we have, it takes effect 90 days after we pass it or even immediately. In the case of this bill, the effective date is 2 years from now or 2 years from when it's passed, because we need to get the IT system all built up and tested and double-checked and so forth. So I would say, the prosecutor's concerns will be heard and have been heard and will continue to be heard, over the next couple of years, as well as concerns other people may have. But I think the intent is clear. And when you have this wide support for the idea behind it, we shouldn't let a technical hurdle or, objections stop the intent. We should figure out a way to make it work.
Let's just talk big for a moment, Representative. There is this national shift in the way we look at criminal justice reform, and we look at incarceration and people who are incarcerated. How do you see these bills fitting into that national movement?
Well, you're absolutely right, and I think to maybe put a little bit finer point on it, I think there's a larger conversation about the amount of incarceration, not incarceration per se. You know, we always will have victims of crime. If there's a crime, we should always keep in mind the victim's rights and restitution and notification and all those things. We can't forget that there were victims. But we are, you're right, as we look at criminal justice reform and the criminal justice system, it breaks down, in my mind, into different components. There's the deterrence component. There's the punishment component. But there's also the rehabilitation component. And that's kind of where this, I think, dovetails into that role, where we are looking at criminal justice in this reform movement, if you want to call it that, or this sort of ethos that we have right now. Are we doing all we can with rehabilitation and reintegration? I don't think people are really interested in doing anything less for victims or less for their rights, but I think we are interested in doing more as a society in helping people that are successfully rehabilitated reenter society. And so that our better impulses to have these people reintegrate are not held up by barriers that may be there. The data tell us that when people are given a fresh start and a clean slate, then the set-aside will allow them to be seen not as former offenders, but as employees and taxpayers and fellow members of our communities. So that's what it's really all about, I think, is to make our society's goals for rehabilitation and reintegration match up with what we hope they would be.
Republican State Representative Eric Lighthizer, who is from the 58th District, and we want to thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Been great to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Coming up, how do you remain a father while you're locked up in prison? We'll hear from one inmate trying his best to be part of his kids' lives. More from our series Life on the Inside after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A prison sentence doesn't just impact the person behind those prison walls. It has ripple effects on everyone in their life, especially true for incarcerated parents. They miss birthdays, graduations, the day-to-day lives of their kids. Staying connected to their children often requires a parent to have a village of people on the outside who are willing to help. One of the most important people in Duan Quinn's village is his sister, Tondalea Jones Quinn. While Stateside was at Lakeland Correctional Facility, we recorded a conversation between the siblings about how they have stayed connected as a family while Duan is incarcerated.
My name is Duan Quinn. I'm from Muskegon, Michigan. Currently, I'm incarcerated at Lakeland Correctional Facility. I've been here about 5 years. I am serving a 25 to 75 year sentence. Well, I have three kids. My oldest is Kawana, and Kawana is 17. My younger daughter is 15, Ariana, and my son, Duan, he'll be 12 this December.
And my name is Tondalea Jones Quinn. I'm the sister of Duan Quinn. I reside in Norton Shores, Michigan. So the first question is, what are the hardest parts about being a parent while you're in prison?
Well, the hardest part of being a parent in prison is missing everything, hearing everything and seeing everything, so much later than it actually happens. And sometimes through that process, you miss things. You don't hear about things, It's not being able to get your input, to show them the way instead of just always, talking. So let me ask you a question. How would you describe our relationship?
As kids, as children, we didn't have a stable, home, or we didn't have a mom and dad, the typical family, kind of like what, right. My kids have now. Well, we didn't have that. So, there's not a whole lot of people that I had a whole lot of respect for because I didn't have a mom or a dad, right? But you were that person. So, for sure, a best friend, I view you. I think I wrote you and even told you, you know, I know you've made mistakes, but even a role model, I definitely view you as a role model. You are someone that I admire and have utmost respect for, even with the, you know, bad choices that you made, you know, that back that day. I know that if you could take it back, you would. How often do you get a chance to see your kids in person?
Usually I get a chance to see them 2 or 3 times a year.
Do you have a particular favorite memory of your visit?
A particular favorite memory of a visit? Yeah, I do. It was when I first came down and I held my son for the first time. It was pretty special. And I remember Ariana telling me, I guess she felt it. She said, well, don't worry, Dad, I'll take care of him. So that always sticks out to me. What I was feeling in that moment was, I just couldn't believe that, you know, she can read me like that. As a child, she might have been 4. And it did bring me comfort, because you want your kid showing up to be close, and you're not there, so you need all the protection that you can get, you know? So I was grateful that, she, you know, her little heart touched me like that, and she was able to say that. And those words, I have a picture of them holding each other from that age. I think of that memory, and the picture comes to mind, you know? You know, even though she's a child, it did bring me relief.
So when we, you know, when the kids and I or mom and all of us come see you, how does it feel when that visit is over?
Immediately seeing you all leave, it does hurt. You got to regroup. You got to regather yourself. You know, you begin to reflect over everything, and you're hoping that you touched on everything that you want. You know, I'm the type, I write notes, you know. So before I come out, I try to write notes and put them in my head so I know to hit this, this, and that. You know what I mean? And then also, you know, it's you, it's mom, might be both of the kids. So you want to make sure you interact with everybody. But at first, it's a feeling of they're leaving again. Got to go back and start this process of, you know, being an inmate, being a prisoner again, you know. But you may look at the pictures or you think about the conversations, and before you make it back to the unit, you're like, well, that was a pleasant time. That was a great time. It was a great memory. And, you know, you bring that joy. Actually, you bring the joy back to the compound. You know, you may talk to friends or associates or, you know, homeboys or whatever you may have you. And, you know, seeing your joy, you telling them real true-to-life stories and things of that nature, you know, it brings them a little joy and happiness, believe it or not. It's like a trickle-down effect. At times, do you feel more like a, you know, unofficial parent because of all the responsibilities and duties you have taken on helping me to have a relationship with the kids?
No, not at all. I don't know. I just feel like it's my responsibility or duty as a sister to do the things that I know you would do for me, to definitely step up and do whatever I can to help out. Yeah, they're my family. They're my blood too. So, it's not an issue at all for me, not at all, not one bit. Do you talk to the kids about life after you get out of prison?
That's a difficult question. Talking to the kids about life when I get out of prison, because kids, like, next week is a long time away for them. Next year is forever, and the world changes so fast. To speak on 2033, I believe it's difficult. Every now and then, I talk about things that I would like to do with them. But as far as that date, you know, I mean, I remember me and Avery had a conversation, and she said, I'm going to be, you know, 30 years old when you get out. And I was like, well, yeah, if you believe that. I don't believe that, and I hope I get home sooner than later. But right now, yeah, you're right. And, yeah. You'll be 30 years old, and I might be standing in your basement. She's like, ugh, you know. And we kind of, you know, got past it, and, you know, but it's something that they do know. And I'm pretty sure it's, you know, devastating to them as well. What do you think it'll be like when I'm back home?
I don't know. I say this all the time, like, and you don't know how often I say this. Oh, my gosh, if my brother was home. I wish my brother was home. Like, I've been saying it from day one. I just feel like as a whole, as a family, as a unit, our life would be so much better. You're a person that no one wants to disappoint, first of all, and you're a person that you can get your point across to us just by words, and we know that, you know, what you say, you mean. So I just know that life would be so much better if you were home. And, you know, I've always had you, you know, I've always had a big brother, and I've always been able to come to you and talk to you about anything. And, you know, a lot of times you didn't have a whole lot of time. But, you know, if I called you, you would be there. If I needed something, you would be there financially, emotionally. I remember when you were, when we were, living with grandma. I just remember when we, when you live with grandma and she, you end up having to leave. And I just remember how, you know, empty I felt, you know, I just feel that same emptiness now. So when it comes down to your kids, what advice do you try to drive home to the kids the most?
Well, first, I just think that kids need to know that they're loved, that I love them so much. And that I'm so proud of them, and I'm so thankful that they are strong enough. I want them to know that they can be successful, that they work hard, that the reward will be worth it. I try to tell them that don't let me being in this situation be such a burden or a hamper on their life and their ability to succeed. If anything, to use it as a driving force, you know, to be a better person, to be a strong individual. How has me being locked up affected you and our family?
Tremendously. You've always been the backbone.
All right. Take your time. Gather yourself.
Yeah. You've always been the backbone of the family, you know, being the oldest. So now it just kind of, you know, it leaves a little bit more pressure on me to kind of pick up, you know, the things that you normally handle. So yeah, it's definitely affected me. You've been away from us.
Can I ask you, how have you gotten through it? What gives you strength to get through it?
I guess just the conversations, still being able to talk to you, having those conversations over the phone. And just because you're in prison, it doesn't mean that, you know, you're still here.
I know that, you know, when you hurt, I hurt, you know, and I can hear it in your voice. And I just want to tell you that, you know, I get my strength from you, from the kids, from the family. So I'm not really doing this on my own. I don't, you know, if I could do it without you all.
That was Duane Quinn and his sister Tondalea Quinn. Duane is an inmate at Lakeland Correctional Facility. As we continue our series, Life on the Inside, we turn our focus on those inmates serving life sentences. Michigan radio reporter Dustin Dwyer was part of the team that visited Lakeland Correctional Facility. He talked to one lifer there whose situation stood out. After we left, he did a little digging. Stateside host Lester Graham takes it from here.
More than 40% of the prisoners at Lakeland are lifers, but not every life sentence is the same. We've reported a lot on the lifers who were sentenced for crimes they committed before they were 18. Some of those lifers have a new sense of hope after the Supreme Court decided that sentencing juveniles to life without the possibility of parole is unconstitutional. But there's another group of people convicted as juveniles who aren't affected by that decision. These are people who got a life sentence with the possibility of parole. Their situation is, in some ways, a lot more complicated. Dustin Dwyer has the story of one of those inmates from Lakeland, and Dustin joins us now. Hi there.
Hey, Lester.
So you talked to a few juvenile lifers at Lakeland. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, I talked to three people total who were sentenced as juveniles without the possibility of parole. Their cases are all being reconsidered because of that U.S. Supreme Court decision. But as I was in the yard, sort of walking through the yard there at Lakeland, this other guy stopped me, and he wanted to talk.
Well, what is this about?
I'm a news reporter. I was looking for juvenile lifers.
Yeah, and I'm one. And I'm a parolable lifer. I'm a juvenile parolable.
Where's your ID? Let me see your ID.
That last voice you hear there, Lester, is one of the administrators at the prison who was walking around with us. He didn't recognize this guy, and this guy said he'd been locked up more than 35 years, but he looks really young. He looks too young to have been locked up that long. But his story checks out. His name is Raymond Richardson. He says people call him Remo. And the reason his case is different, like we said, it's not affected by the Supreme Court decision, is because he's a parolable lifer. The Michigan Department of Corrections says there are more than 800 parolable lifers in Michigan prisons who are eligible for parole consideration. And the organization Safe and Just Michigan estimates more than 60 of them were sentenced as juveniles, like Richardson. But the thing Richardson told me is just because he's eligible for parole doesn't mean he feels like he has a real shot at parole.
Yeah, I've been walking around here for 36 years since I was 15, and I don't see where I'm ever getting out. The parole board people, we don't want to talk to you. You know? Why? I'm saying, at what point do I, they say I got a possible chance for parole, but at what point do I get my possible chance? I don't understand that, sir.
So what's he talking about here? He's a parolable lifer. There is a parole board. There are rules about how these cases are reviewed, right?
Yes, but it really comes down to the members of the parole board. And the members of the parole board change over time. They've changed several times in the 35-plus years that Richardson has been locked up. Basically, as it stands now, the rules say if you have a parolable life sentence, the parole board will look at your case after 15 years. Usually, that part doesn't end in parole. And after that, the board looks at your case every 5 years. But they don't have to hold a hearing or even talk to the prisoner. They can just review the file. And for Raymond Richardson, his file has some bad stuff in it. He was convicted for a robbery in which he held people hostage. He sexually assaulted a woman and shot someone, according to a Detroit Free Press article from the time. But what he's saying now is he was 15 years old. He spent more than twice as long in prison. And he says he's done everything he can in prison to show he's rehabilitated. He has a job. He takes self-improvement classes. He has his GED, he says. And the file review, he says, doesn't give him a chance to show who he really is today. It doesn't give him a meaningful chance at parole, as he puts it. So, Lester, I called someone who's worked on prison reform issues for a long time. Barbara Levine was the head of the organization now known as Safe and Just Michigan. Officially, she's retired, but she's written reports on the issue of parolable lifers. The most recent was in 2014. And she said in the 1970s and 80s, back when Richardson was sentenced, life with parole meant something very different to judges than it does now.
Back in the day, when a lot of these sentences were being imposed, you know, there was an expectation on the part of judges that people might not get out in 10, but they'd get out in 12 or 14 years.
Levine is not just making this up. In her 2014 report, she surveyed judges on this, and she found that for two-thirds of them, they didn't agree with the idea that life with parole meant that the prisoner would stay their whole life in prison. But a lot of prosecutors see it that way. So I also talked to Bill Valancourt. He's the prosecutor in Livingston County, and he's the president of the Prosecuting Attorneys Association of Michigan. He told me every case is different, but yeah, basically life means life.
I mean, it's always been the practice and the law that a person who receives a life sentence is eligible for parole consideration, but I think everyone has always understood that, you know, that means it's up to the parole board to make those determinations.
Okay, so does the parole board say anything about this?
Well, I contacted the MDOC. I was told the parole board doesn't really give comments on policies like this. But we do know that the makeup of the parole board does change, and so its views can change. And over at Safe and Just Michigan, they've been tracking the number of parolable lifers who actually get parole. And in recent years, those numbers have been going up. More parolable lifers are getting out. But reformers like Levine and the folks at Safe and Just Michigan, they want to see more changes to give even more chances for parole. There was legislation introduced in 2014 that it kind of went nowhere at the time, but it could come back. One big idea in there is to change it so that cases are reviewed every 2 years instead of every five, and that every case would involve at least a video chat or an interview so that the prisoner could make their case instead of just have their file reviewed.
What does this mean for the guy you talked to, the person we heard at the beginning of your story, Raymond Richardson?
Well, as we said at the top, the Supreme Court case on juvenile lifers, it doesn't apply to him. He is trying to challenge that in Wayne County, but other courts have already ruled on it, so that would be a difficult case for him to win. The Wayne County Prosecutor's Office, when I reached out to them, they told me its stance is that lifers should only be granted parole based on extraordinary behavior on the part of the prisoner. Richardson told me his next parole board review is in 2021, and he says he dreams about getting out. He dreams about getting his chance to prove he can be a productive member of society and just live a normal life. Remember, he first went to prison when he was 15 years old.
Man, I never even drove a car yet, man. You know what I'm saying? That's one of my biggest dreams, of just going and getting my licenses and learning to drive, man.
What kind of car would you drive?
Any kind, man. I drive anything that's available that's going to get me from point A to point B, man.
Dustin Dwyer is with Michigan Radio. He was one of the reporters contributing to Stateside's Life on the Inside series. Thanks, Dustin.
Thank you, Lester.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we expand our focus on lifers at Lakeland Correctional Facility with a special hour-long documentary.
It's a hurting feeling to dream and be free and wake up and to be looking at the bottom of a steel bunk.
The documentary Life on the Inside, tomorrow on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.